You're now diving into the fish tank.
Sitting down with Seth Living, OJ, Juice Man, ooh, and this is strictly for them true fans, dog fans, number one. Of course, y'all, this ain't no ordinary sports talk.
Welcome back to the Fish Tank right here on the Miami Dolphins Podcast Network. Seth Levitt, DJ Preach is in the back making sure the board is straight, and my main man wearing the 305, OJ McDuffie, Juice.
Also, okay, good. Repping ready. The fish tank, too. Got to rep the tank, you know what I mean? Yeah. We got to rep the tank, too. You know how that is, man. You know, I'm too big to be in that, over that, be in that shot, Big Seth. You know what I mean? I'm a big dude now, you know? I'm still about, you know, I'm 2 pounds over my playing weight.
2 pounds over your playing weight and 2 years, now a little more than 2 years away from your playing weight.
Right. Just a couple years.
Something like that.
But that's okay.
Well, here's a man who never cared about his playing weight, and I am fired up for this interview, and I know I say it all the time. But I want to welcome in Alex, the dude, Marvez. And I'm going to tell him why we call him the dude, but how are you feeling, Marvez?
I am so honored to be here in the fish tank, you know, and it's so funny because I go back, you know, more than 20 years with both of you. Seth, I believe one time I asked you to leave your hotel room so one of the PR interns could go ahead and maybe have a fun night out on the town.
I said no, go find another damn room. He's an intern.
Yeah, he was an intern. Maybe if it was a full-timer, maybe it'd be a little bit different, but I remember that. And right. Of course, Juice would go back a long way, went to weddings together back you know, when you were rubbing around with Kajana Carter down in South Florida, right. And of course, right. Kajana living down there. It is so good to be with both of you. I cannot wait to go down memory lane talking about my days covering the Dolphins.
Oh, man.
Yeah,
so good,
I'm fired up about it. And so, Juice, if you hear me go into calling him dude as opposed right. to Alex or Marvez, you have to understand, and the folks listening have to understand, the guy you see before you now or that you're listening to, this is the grown-up version of Alex Marvez. But the dude was, I mean, you showed up on the beat, and it was like no writer we had ever seen before. You had the, mullet slash kind of ponytail going on, goatee, or maybe yeah. something different. And everybody was dude. And, I think it was right around the time that the Big Lebowski was doing their thing. So it was definitely a new voice and a fresh personality on the beat.
Well, and, you know, one of the reasons I did a lot of that stuff was it didn't hurt to be different. You know what I mean? Yeah. Didn't hurt to be a little bit counterculture. Maybe I could be a little more relatable to the players that were involved. I handled myself as professionally as I could at the time, mind you. But it was just something that was just the way I was living my life, too. I mean, it was, you know, carefree coming back to South Florida. I just finished a stint covering the Denver Broncos 2 years before that. The Cincinnati Bengals. And, you know, it was just such an honor to come back home, right? You know, my dad had been not too good a shape. He passed away shortly after I came back on the beat. So I'm glad I got to spend about 3 months, you know, really with him and be there for my mom as, you know, she dealt with the fallout of all that. And I mean, you're covering your hometown team. Now, I admit, I was not a Miami Dolphins fan growing up. I was a San
Diego.
That's
a damn shame. That's a damn shame, Marvin. I wasn't even going to go there with this, man, but that's a damn shame.
I was a Chargers fan growing up, believe it or not. It was Dan Fouts and the uniforms and all of that.
I get it.
To cover this team, to have a chance to go to the Sun Sentinel was just amazing. And listen, that beat was one of the most competitive in the country. You look at some of the people who were involved, we're all Pro Football Hall of Fame voters to an extent, right? I mean, you're talking about Armando Salguero, Jason Cole, Todd Archer, one of the very best beat reporters that there is, now with ESPN Dallas for almost 20 years, covering the Cowboys, which in human years is about 150 with the way that beat is.
Right.
I mean,
right.
And you know, just the number of characters that have gone in and out covering this team. So the fact that I got to rub elbows with all of them was just an incredible thing. And it was an interesting era because we were transitioning from newspapers to the internet. And it was so different, guys. I mean, you know, went back
God,
in the late 90s.
That makes it sound so flipping old, though, man.
I know, man. We're so old
it's
now,
true.
Bro.
It's true, though. Like, you would write a story, and then you would just keep your fingers crossed. It would hold up to the next morning. You know,
right. We're going to get into all of that. Yeah, we're going to get into all of that. You're all in our playbook right now, but we definitely want to ask you about all of that.
Yeah, you know that. You know, you talked about it a little bit, man. Before you even got down here, let's go back and, you know, you came down here in 1999, but you know, you spent the couple years you talked about right now in Denver, back-to-back Super Bowl champion seasons. And now we're going to spend some time, you know, discussing how competitive the Dolphins beat was, as you're talking about a little bit, compared to what you were dealing with Denver. I mean, you were writing for the, you know, for the Rocky Mountain News, But there's another guy writing for the rival Denver Post, you know, the rival newspaper named Adam Schefter.
Yeah.
How was that? Well, that how was that, Marvin?
That was miserable. Absolutely, absolutely horrendously miserable. Listen, Schefter's a great reporter, and I have a funny story for you. The Washington Post wrote a feature on Adam Schefter this summer, and it was a bit controversial, and the writer of the story, Ben Strauss, had reached out to me, basically looking for anecdotes on Adam on the beat. And I said, no. You know what? It's like, I just wanted to leave all that aggravation behind. You know, one thing that he was able to do was build a very cozy relationship with Mike Shanahan, and it paid huge dividends, you know, when it came to getting news. And it was very frustrating because when I started on the Bengals beat, I worked my way up and hard work paid off. When it came to what I was doing in Denver, you have to go about it a different way. I mean, and I listen, I did some things I'm not necessarily proud of. When Mike Shanahan wouldn't give a vote of confidence to Greg Robinson coming back as his defensive coordinator, I saved the story for Christmas morning. And I put it out then, you know? I mean, just stuff like that. I was going crazy. And sometimes the beat would make you do that. So it was just a very difficult thing working against someone like that. Obviously, Adam has become, you know, he's you know, one of the best insiders. To me, Jay Glazer's my guy. I'm never going to say Adam's the best because Jay is. But that being said, I you know, it was very tough. But you know what it did too? It hardened me up, right? And what it also led to was people who felt sorry for me in the journalism business, quite honestly. And I'll give you an example here. One of my first scoops that I got was Bernie Parmalee being cut by the Dolphins at the end of training camp in 1999, at the end of the preseason. Nobody else had it, and it was like the way I splashed on the beat. I got that tip from another reporter who just wanted me to get off to a good start on the Dolphins beat. They had seen the NFL Wire. Wow. They had told me this, and then I had it. So I was like, great. And then that helped establish my name in South Florida. Again, you're working against some of the very best people in journalism. At that time, covering the Miami Dolphins, I had to do something. And fortunately, that experience in Denver did prepare me for what was to come.
Yeah, I feel, you know, it's interesting. I don't think that folks necessarily understand that. We know right. that the sport you cover is competitive. And like we just had Brendan Ayamadejo on, who was amazing. What a great guest. But and he talked about his journey of 4 years of trying to get to the NFL and getting cut by all different teams and going to different leagues. And he talked about how difficult it was, but he also used a term and it stood out to me. He said, I was forged in all of that adversity. And, you know, the coach here with the Dolphins now, Mike McDaniel, talks about adversity as opportunity. So, but to hear, we don't think about that from a beat reporter. We don't think about, and I don't know, and some of that, maybe we'll get into this now, is I don't know if competition on the beat is different now than what it was back then, but I think it's pretty cool to hear about how it did toughen you up.
Well, no, it's different because what happens now, listen, the national folks, they all get the same text from the same agent, Schefter, Rappaport. I mean, I had a head coach tell me this, you know, because we were talking as a story broke and he goes, yeah, I guess Jimmy Sexton sent out the text, you know, the famous agent. So everyone gets it at the same time because the agent doesn't want to necessarily show, special treatment to one insider over another. So what has happened right. is you have this cottage industry now of NFL Network, ESPN. They get spoon-fed the information. Back then, you didn't have that. You had Chris Mortensen and you had insiders, but you could still build relationships with agents, you know, locally. I mean, it was a very big deal. Drew Rosenhaus cared about what was in the South Florida newspapers. Other agents, Neil Schwartz did, you know, who represented a number of Dolphins players. They all cared about what it is that you wrote. And that was a big deal. And when you talk about beat writing, I mean, you took it like a win and loss. But every day, it was almost like you played a 365-day-a-year schedule of did I have this story? Did I not have this story? How did this writer get this story? I mean, this is what you want as a beat writer. You wanted me, someone with no life, someone who would throw away things, Christmas holidays, New Year's, and Thanksgiving, anything to be able to get a scoop. Head to the airport before all the security issues to meet Underwood. What was his name? Underwood, right?
Demetrius Underwood.
Yeah. We went ahead and met with him. And God, I mean, some of the stuff was just absolutely wild. But you would do that stuff back then. I remember one time getting quotes and seeing Todd Archer pulling up to the airport just as the car of this guy for the Dolphins was leaving. And he was cursing. I mean, this was how it was. And you'd go into the press room the next day and sometimes you walk in and your chest is all puffed up. Other times you're fussing under your breath, don't want to talk to anybody. I mean, it was how it was. And the other thing was we all went about it a little bit differently, right? I mean, some of us had different sources in different places. So, you know, you just, it was just a very competitive time in my life. And one of the reasons I have absolutely no desire to become a beat writer again is because if you cannot do this job 24 hours a day and consider it your child, that's really what it is. You know, if you don't have that type of pride that you want to have every single story, you want to get everything right, you want to be first on everything, then you shouldn't be doing the job.
Damn, that is, yeah, that sounds stressful, bro.
It is.
It's probably eye-opening for you, right? You just saw the end result, and it didn't matter who the writer is. Yeah. It pissed you off, or you were happy about it.
I know. Yeah. I remember talking about, I mean, I hear about deadlines and everything, but damn, right, you're right. Especially nowadays when all you got to do is press send on the story now to get them out there before anybody else gets them out.
Yeah,
there.
And it's also a people business, OJ. You go in the locker room, right? Yeah. I wrote something, and Seth, you can understand this, you know, being as close as you are with Jason Taylor. I made a huge mistake. I'll be the first to admit it. I still feel bad about it 23 years later. Jason Taylor in 1999 put out a swimsuit calendar or a modeling calendar. That's what it was, right? And basically, I made a comment that basically these calendars are going to go to 75% off because he's playing so poorly. It was an offhanded, stupid comment to make. And he approached me in the locker room and told me about it. And it took a long time to get JT's trust back. And I really do. Yeah, to this day, I still feel badly about it. I made a big mistake, but I learned a valuable lesson as well. If you're going to write something, okay, be there the next day. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And so it makes you think a little bit, because we had hit and run columnists who would write things and then never show up and they're not accountable. Yeah. Or people would say things on the radio maybe, and they're not in the locker room. I do give Dave Hyde credit. Dave Hyde had a throwaway line about Jimmy Johnson's dog, Buttercup. And he
talked about it on the show.
Poor Buttercup, right? And so he brings it out. And Jimmy, I told Dave, can you please come out? He comes out and Jimmy just looks at him and goes, "To trash a little dog." And he just gets tested and walks off and ends the news conference. That was it. But Dave had the guts to show up and be right there for it, you know, unlike a lot of other people. But that's part of it too. OJ is relationship business. I told Randy McMichael he was being cut by the Dolphins. I told him this. I told another player who was cut by Nick Saban, who was at a Christmas function, Poole, the cornerback from back in the day from Southern Cal. He didn't know,
Poole.
You know, because no one could get a hold of him. I don't want to be that guy, you know, the guy. I shouldn't be the person telling you you've been released from a team, your employment's done. But I did have enough of a relationship to try to give someone a heads up, try to be sympathetic. And I like to think that I forged a pretty good relationship with players, which, again, when you're building sources, I think you want to be not just beholden to agents or particular coaches when it comes to covering a beat.
Yeah, you got to, I imagine it's a holistic process, right? You know, you want to have the ability to have access to information from everywhere. But so here's a kind of pivoting off. I wanted to ask you about how competitive it was. And if you thought you were coming down to palm trees and sunshine and that it would be different than Denver, but it was different, but it was competitive in its own right, as you just talked about, because of those names. We've had Armando out here, you know, and Armando's a killer, man. Armando's like, he wants to win everything. And it's what made him great at his job. It's what I think makes him great. And we're going to talk about the Hall of Fame piece as well. And so it, I think for Juice, it's really eye-opening to see, and because he loves good competition, and to see that existed amongst you all. Because again, it was something that I don't think he was ever exposed to. But what about and you haven't been a beat writer in a long, long time, but you also didn't have to deal with Twitter. You were only competing with print headlines. And as you said, it did transition into internet, but I don't even think newspapers even knew what to do with the internet at that point. And they were trying to hold certain content back because they wanted to still sell papers and everything. And now it is such a right now business with respect to information. And I always talk about, if I talk to young people who are getting into the industry, it used to be a race to be right. And sometimes now it feels like it's a race to be first. And it's so easy to correct yourself now, because you can just delete a tweet, you know, quote tweet the old tweet and say, oh, here's a correction. Whereas something that was in print was going to live in print forever. A retraction wouldn't be printed for 24 hours. And if it was, who knows? I remember Harvey, I don't want a damn retraction. It's going to be on page 11 at the bottom. You know, and he didn't want to hear that. When something else was this big headline above the fold on the front page. How much has that changed the industry?
Oh, it's changed it so much. And what I'm amazed at is I'm a news aggregator now. I'm full-time at SiriusXM NFL Radio. And I sit there on Sunday. I watch all, you know, 7-8 games at once on my TV, right, on DirecTV, channel 702. It's a godsend. And I'm watching people give me information for free. Maybe they just want to show how smart they are. Maybe they want to try to build their own brand. I don't know. I can just call the internet and get so much information. But when you're writing now, it's interesting because of the marriage between what a newspaper is now. And you just can't think of the brick and mortar buildings. You can't think of the printing press because they're trying to get rid of all that. You almost have to write based upon, you know, where do I take a story after it breaks? You know, how do I advance a story? It used to be you would wake up in the morning if you got scooped on something and you'd be trying to do that the next day. Now it's instantaneous. You're on call pretty much 24 hours a day when it comes to news. And that's been the big thing about Twitter. And Seth, if you have any young people that tell you they want to get into journalism, please tell them to get the heck out of it. Please tell them to never go down this road. You work forever. You don't get paid a heck of a lot unless you're able to find a really top flight gig. And it's just a thankless type of employment. I mean, if you're really that curious a person or feel like you're going to change the world, hey, more power to you. But it's a pretty miserable deal when it comes to beat work. And I feel for people when it comes to, you know, trying to cover a team because of all the different things now. And remember, too, you've got different types of media outlets that are providing different type of content. You know what I mean? You got new stuff that's coming from places you would have never seen before because the NFL is so big and because everyone is trying to grab that, you know, sliver of the journalism pie, so to speak. So things have changed in that regard as well. But no, completely different world. When I worked at Fox, I left the Sun Sentinel in 2007 to become a Fox NFL writer. And, you know, that's really when Twitter was starting to truly take off. And it's great to be first. At the end of the day, though, how did that really help Fox? Did it drive traffic to people going to the website? No, people just want to see, okay, this happened. That's it. So I don't see what the payoff is a lot of times in the news breaking business.
No doubt about it, man.
What's up? I'm John Wall.
And I'm CJ Toledano, and we're starting a new podcast presented by DraftKings called Point Game. We're now joined by 3-time NBA Sixth Man of the Year, elite bucket getter. Let's please welcome Jamal Crawford to Point Game. King of the Court one-on-one tournament. If they had it back in your prime, do you think he could have took it all?
I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think I could have took it all, but I think I would have shocked a lot of people. I think Kobe and everybody in their prime, Kobe would win a one-on-one contest.
Yeah, because you got to think, he's going to guard. He don't care about guarding.
He's going to guard.
He's going to guard. Like, you see him in the Olympics, he's going to guard. And then on top of that.
Like that, see that?
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Sam Cassell to Point Game.
I remember you came to my room crying tears. I mean, he was in a culture shock. And then he's going to withdraw us about winning.
Remember what I told you? I said, OG, you think I can get paid and go back and play in college because it ain't it?
Check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, DraftKings YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, you know what? Alex, I know Seth loves talking about the writers and the PR guys and stuff like that, but there was also a football team to cover, man. There's football. And those first 2 years, you know, had to be very interesting for you. I mean, hell, man, let me think about it. Jimmy Johnson quits, but Wayne and Dan talking back into the game. Did Wayne really offer Jimmy just an opportunity to coach home games?
So, you know, I believe that is the case. And I will tell you, I hit the ground running a little bit on this. I came in the summer of 1999, back when Jimmy had quit. Basically came back, and he was willing to do anything. Listen, if you remember, Jimmy got in some hot water because he sent Dave Wanstead to a league meeting. You know, and this was one of the caveats that Wayne had offered Jimmy, like, hey, listen, we'll let you do basically whatever you want. Please stay as our head coach. And it's funny when you look back at that decision now. Poor Wayne. Wayne Huizenga was a wonderfully nice guy who was looking for the right person to run his football team. You know, Wayne Huizenga was looking for the right people, and he tried so many different ways to get this thing right. First, it was Jimmy Johnson. Then he trusted Jimmy that Dave Wanstead was the right guy. Then it was Nick Saban. Then it was failing forward fast with Cam Cameron. You know, and it was just like nonstop of just him just not being able to get this right. Hopefully the people are in place now that are going to help lead the Dolphins to, you know, playoff appearances, victories, being a good team every year. And I think that the one good thing about Jimmy Johnson is he got out at the right time. And when I say that, I mean it in that it allowed him to like live his life and to find out there's more outside of football. And, you know, he's still very close to the game, obviously, and has been for a number of years. But I think just stepping away from the pressure cooker of football, building a better relationship with his family, with his sons, you know, a new wife, all those sorts of things, I just think was the best thing for Jimmy Johnson, the human being who was really lacking at times in that way when he was head coach of the Dolphins. And then you think about some of the cast of characters. I mentioned Demetrius Underwood. I was thinking the other day, Cecil Collins. you know, that one. Yeah. You know, you have, you know, I didn't get to cover Lawrence Phillips. Thank God for that. But if there was a player with any sort of talent, Jimmy was willing to bring them in and give them a chance. And some, it didn't, in this case, it did not pay off. It happened, you know, look, Chris Carter, more power to him, paid off for the Minnesota Vikings. No question, right? Not so much for the Dolphins. It seemed like every time they brought someone in with an off-field issue, it manifested itself in South Florida.
So it's interesting, though, right? Because also, like, how do you define work out? Granted, the Super Bowl is the ultimate goal, but the team also did go to the Super Bowl, or to, excuse me, to the playoffs 5 straight years. And then, you know, it's been a lot of difficulty since then. And some of that was under Dave, and certainly some of that was under Jimmy. Juice doesn't want to hear what I'm saying here. But I think OJ's point is, like, the defense was really built up. And we're going to talk about some of those players. But the defense was built to be one of the best defenses that's ever been. Obviously, we had the no-name in the 70s. But certainly the fans that listen to this show, and they know that defense, it was significant. They just, it, what happened to the offense just kind of crippled or put a glass ceiling, you know, and the team could only go so far.
Yeah, and I think that was the biggest problem. You know, I mean, I thought one thing we were doing before that was scoring points, you know, and then the next thing you know, we had a great defense, but, you know, we were trying to play, in my opinion, Marvez, we were trying to do Dallas offense without Dallas personnel.
And it came with Dave, and it continued with Wanstead, right? Yep. And I, you know, listen, yep. I like Dave a heck of a lot. He was good to me on the beat. We can talk about that. But I also realized, too, it's like, you know, okay, I'm not going to do my Wanstead impression, but we're going to play defense. We're going to win the
come
game.
On.
We're going to run the ball. Play defense, and we're going to win the game in the fourth quarter. Okay, but then the counter is, Dave, what if you pass the ball in the first three quarters? You'd have a huge lead. It wouldn't matter. Nah, we're going to run the ball. We're going to play deep and win in the fourth quarter. And it was this formula that with a conservative coach like Dave, that it just didn't work. You had to make plays in the passing game. This was not a team that was well-equipped to do that. I think one of the big things that happened, too, once Norv Turner left and became Raiders head coach, that became a real struggle for him to try to find someone else to run this offense. I think, too, he trusted Jay Fiedler, but Jay had his limitations. And I just know, you know, and I love me some Jay Fiedler, but he was only going to get you so far. You either have that quarterback or you don't. And you compound that with some offensive philosophy issues. You compound that with some personnel issues. You know, once Richmond Webb was gone at left tackle, that became a revolving door of talent as well. And then as that defense got older, got a little bit more injury prone, you know, Larry Chester suffering that torn ACL. He had been replacing Darryl Gardner. Tim Bowen's getting older. You know, just they didn't find the right types of replacements. And it was a Dolphins team that almost was always looking for the quick fix, right? Trade draft picks, bring someone in, you know, and it just didn't pay off. And it left a team that obviously went 4-12 in 2004 and won the Nick Saban, Cam Cameron. I can go on the list here, late, great Tony Sperano, you know, Adam Gase, whomever, just couldn't get this thing fixed.
Yeah, yeah, it was a whole lot of that. Let's go back to Dave, though. You mentioned he was good to you on the beat. You and Dave Wanstead had a very interesting relationship.
We did. You know, first, I think he felt that people were out to get him, whether it be, you know, Jason Cole, Armando Salguero. He just didn't really consider the Palm Beach Post people too much as like the main newspaper. You know, he just didn't, and that's no disrespect. Joe Shad is great. Todd Archer is great. I mean, these are people who wrote, you know, Joe to this day continues to cover the beat.
And took their careers to a national level after that, for sure.
I mean, but the thing was that he didn't get the Palm Beach Post delivered to his house every day. He wasn't living in Palm Beach. I mean, the Herald and the Sun Sentinel were really the two papers. And I started a good relationship with Dave back in 1999 before he became head coach. I talked to him. We get into conversations and he made his own judgment and
did you get him a gift?
What? No, I didn't.
Dude, did you get him a gift?
I did. I do have a Dave Wanstead bobblehead doll from a charity thing that he did with the great Lou Sahadi back in the old days. You know, doing
Lou Sahadi.
And Lou Sahadi still going strong, by the way, in his early 90s. I do want to point that out. But that being said, you know, so he trusted me. So it led to, you know, the ability to ask him questions and to be able to get information. I mean, that's what beat writing is, right? You build that relationship with someone and you try to take advantage of it. I mean, no payola was ever exchanged, nothing like that. But Dave liked the way I handled myself, liked the way I covered this beat. Look, we had problems. I mean, he was upset because I quoted Marcus Spriggs, old Spriggy, about something that, you know, when he was ripping on Dave and Dave called me in his office and screamed at me for 5 minutes. But, you know, that's the other thing, too, that I learned is that you have to sort of let things go. If you're going to be around people every day, you have to be able to let things go. You can't carry a grudge as a writer. And honestly, everyone needs each other. I learned that from Bruce Coslett covering the Bengals, you know, and that really helped me a lot because I had a blow up with Bruce one day when he was a coach there. And, you know, the next day he just acted normal. And I was like, oh, okay, let me learn from this and move on from there. So, yeah, I mean, Dave was good to work with. I mean, honestly, I still have a great relationship with him to this day. Know his wife. I mean, it just he was wonderful to me. What else can I say?
Well, you're both media guys now.
I know.
It's a whole different
deal. That's right. That's right. Same family now.
Which is crazy because Dave would get knocked for all, like, not being good with the media. And now he's absolutely fantastic at it. I just think it's awesome. I mean, and I you know, I like Dave talking, you know, when he was a quote. He'd give you some stuff. He was good, you know. I don't mind it. I do think he regrets the choice of a lobster trap, though, in the locker room once. So there was a game trap that the Dolphins were about to play, and he put up lobster traps in the locker room.
Trap game,
except nobody knew what a lobster trap was. This wasn't really spelled out very clearly. You are simply looking up at a wooden box and you have no idea what this means. None. It was not an effective pregame message, and the Dolphins did fall into that trap that year.
The trap was the trap. That's exactly what it was. Too much fun. Well, let's shift gears to the players. We talked about the coaches here. Some of the players you had an opportunity to cover. There's a few names that just jump right off the page to me. You know, JT, you talked about JT, and, you know, you got to cover him as a player and then vote for him, you know, as a Hall of Famer. Zach, I'm going to talk about some Zach Thomas, and certainly Ricky Williams, because that was – that was, I imagine, an adventure for you as
well. Look at that head shake, Big Seth. Look at that head shake.
He made my life miserable for four years on this beat. First, he had a cozy relationship with Dan Le Batard. So anything that was going on was going to Dan Le Batard, who worked at the Miami Herald. I worked at the Sun Sentinel. Second, just the easiest things with him were hard. For example, I get commissioned by Sports Illustrated for Kids to write a story about Ricky Williams. And you know, this 2002 season, everything's going great. Midway through, Dolphins are winning. He's leading the league in rushing. Everything couldn't be better, you would think, for Ricky Williams. First question, Ricky, what are you having the most fun with this season? His answer, why do you think I'm having fun? What do I do with this? I told him, Ricky, I'm writing for Sports Illustrated for Kids, okay? Could you please help me out here? But there was that. I remember I had a party at my house. It's 1 a.m. Everyone's, you know, pretty hammered in a shock and development, knowing my situation. So, and then we have
at a Marvez party.
Yeah, we have the TV on, and all of a sudden, breaking news, Ricky Williams retires. And I'm just like, whoa, you know, and it was absolutely stunning. And then trying to track Ricky. Where is Ricky today? Ricky's in Japan. Ricky's sleeping with the Aborigines in New Zealand. Ricky may come back. Ricky may not come back. Why isn't Ricky playing? It became so life-consuming that he did come back, and then he got suspended again, and then he was gone, but he was playing in Canada, and then he came back again. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, I have a good enough relationship with him. We say hello and all this, but I mean, honestly, that's a full-time job. And I remember when the trade was made with Ricky Williams, and I talked with Dave off the record, Dave Wanstead, and I told him caveat emptor on this one, buyer beware, because I had heard so many bad stories, you know, with the way he was living his life in New Orleans, the people around him just dealing with everything. And it ended up, you know, to a large extent hurting Dave. Dave couldn't adjust once Ricky Williams was gone. They never found a bell cow running back. David Boston goes down with an injury in 2004. Had to use Chris Foerster as his offensive coordinator. That was before the
cocaine. I'm going to play devil's advocate for a minute, though, dude. I'm going to play devil's advocate for a minute. So he comes in and he rushes for 1,800 something yards, however many touchdowns, leads the league in rushing. JT leads the league in pass rushing with 18 and a half sacks, and they don't go to the playoffs.
Nope.
You know, was that Ricky Williams' fault? Was that, like, you know, so who's responsible for that? Then he has another 1,300 plus his second year, also leads the league in carries over those 2 years. So, you know, I feel like you said it ended up hurting Dave, and to an extent it did. And interestingly enough, Juice was at a party that Dave Wanstead, a Super Bowl party that Dave Wanstead and Ricky Williams got to see each other for the first time since Ricky's retirement. And it was OJ, it was Dave, and it was Ricky Williams.
And Jimmy Johnson.
Oh, and Jimmy was there.
Yeah, it was all bad up in that bitch. It was all bad.
You know, the whole thing could have been prevented by this, Seth, and this was an organizational thing, paying Ricky Williams. And the Dolphins at the time.
And that's what Ricky told us here. I mean, it was a number of things, and some of which he blamed me for. Right. Or Juice blames me.
Well, 1,000% that's fault. But.
but I mean, you know, but honestly, had they paid him, that was it. If you felt like
I was asking.
Put in clauses that say if this guy is suspended, then, you know, that's the situation, right? You're not going to get paid. But, you know, to hold the contract over his head like that was just wild. So they didn't pay him. And I can understand that. And then to hold the contract over his head was just part of it. I mean, it was just all I'm saying.
There's a lot there. And it's a complex situation. But yes. I just say, you know, I don't want to just sit here and say, poor Dave, Ricky's the bad guy. No. When there's multiple sides to the story.
04 was, I mean, you name it. Like perfect storm, literally. The first game moved. The Tennessee
game.
That's
why I got out, Juice.
Right? I mean, it goes to a Saturday. And then when A.J. Feely comes in, who Dave Wannstedt doesn't want as his quarterback, because you had Wayne Huizenga give Rick Spielman power. Dave Wannstedt hired Rick Spielman. So you had this terrible dynamic going on in the front office. You had a decaying roster. I mean, it was just, you had injuries. I mean, the whole thing was terrible. The Lamar Gordon era, it came and went. I mean, you talk about, you know, footnotes in history.
Was that an era? Did you call that an era?
Horrible. I mean, it was.
I don't think you can call that an era. All right, so let's pivot off of Ricky.
Who was that again?
Third round pick, Juice. Lamar Gordon, ladies and gentlemen. Third round pick.
Yeah. All right, let's go to a happier place. Zach Thomas. What was it like covering Zach Thomas? And then we're going to talk, you know, talk about covering Zach Thomas.
So I have when I talk about footballs, right, I have a Zach Thomas autographed football from 2005 when the Dolphins played the Chargers out there and won. And I went to Zach and just told him about a linebacker in the NFL. I can't remember who it was, but that they had a bunch of interceptions. Like, hey, you know, you see this guy this season? He has 8 interceptions. And he goes, what are you saying? I can't cause turnovers? I'm like, no, I didn't say that at all. Yes, you did. You said it. I'm going to get one Sunday and give you the football. I still have that football. He forced a turnover. So he got the ball, kept it on the sideline, signed it in the locker room to me. And I'm having one hand with a football over here, one hand with a microphone here, talking to him because of that. He was so driven. I feel the other thing about Zach, I mean, look, there was nobody who was going to work harder at their craft than Zach Thomas. In terms of film study, speaking of connections, so Dave Wannstedt let me sit in a linebackers meeting in 04 when Bob Sanders was a coach and I'd covered Bob at the University of Florida. I met him there with Junior Seau and Zach Thomas, and it blew my mind. I sat in on a rookie meeting and what Bob was feeding these guys, and then I sat in when Junior and Zach came in, and they could tell you everything before the snap. Hey, you know what? So the 52, you're lined up 6 inches too far. They're going to run the football this way. They knew everything like to a T. It was ridiculous. And that was just the type of prep that Zach Thomas had. I also think, too, to his detriment, he would play through anything. There were times in the locker room when I talked to Zach that I just didn't think he was right. That was the thing, too, though. Zach just, he would not stop playing football. He was so dedicated to his craft. Hey, I mean, listen, you fill me in now. He's got one vote for me for the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Armando Jason, that's going to be 3. So we'll see. Hopefully this is his year. I feel he didn't get in last year because Sam Mills was in his final year of eligibility and it pulled at a lot of people's heartstrings that he was, you know, this was it and that Zach still has time left. Hopefully this is Zach Thomas's year. He deserves it. You got every ounce of football out of that man's body that you possibly could. And he was a difference maker.
What's up? I'm John Wall.
And I'm CJ Toledano, and we're starting a new podcast presented by DraftKings called Point Game. We're now joined by 3-time NBA Sixth Man of the Year, elite bucket getter. Let's please welcome Jamal Crawford to Point Game. King of the Court one-on-one tournament. If they had it back in your prime, do you think he could have took it all?
I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think I could have took it all, but I think I would have shocked a lot of people. I think Kobe and everybody in their prime, Kobe would win a one-on-one contest.
Yeah, because you got to think, he's going to guard. He don't care about guarding.
He's going to guard.
He's going to guard. Like, you see him in the Olympics, he's going to guard. And then on top of that.
I'm like that, see that?
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Sam Cassell to Point Game.
I remember you came to my room crying tears. I mean, he was in a culture shock. He's going to withdraw us about winning.
Remember what I told you? I said, OG, you think I can get paid and go back and play in college? Because it ain't it.
Check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, DraftKings YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, I mean, that leads right into our next question. Actually, we're going to talk a little bit more about Zach, and I know you have that vote, you know, as a Hall of Fame selector. For one, I mean, how'd you get to be on that panel? Let's start right there.
You know, Joe Horrigan of the Pro Football Hall of Fame saw that, you know, I'd started becoming a national writer. I'd put in my time on the league, and they were looking for someone. And I also was a Pro Football Writers president back in 2007 and 8, I think. So I had a vote for a couple of years, saw that I did my research, saw that I knew the league, and I'm a historian of it. So they offered me an opportunity to become an at-large voter, and I've been able to hold that ever since, you know, and it's been incredible to have that honor.
Yeah, that really is awesome. And, you know, you talked about why Zach probably didn't get in last year, but what about other guys like Richmond Webb and Mark Clayton and guys like that, that, you know, I think that should be, you know, getting in there as well.
So we have a situation here where I can only vote for the people in front of me, right? When we have 15 candidates, it's all I can do. And for whatever reason, they just have not gotten the traction that other candidates have. Mark Clayton, Mark Duper, no traction on the senior committee. Richmond Webb, same thing. I think they're players who are going to be considered among the best of their time. But, Juice, I don't see it happening. It's unfortunate. I mean, heck, Bob Kuchenberg was like, I believe
Baselli got in. Baselli and those guys get in, and Richmond Webb can't get in.
Well, I mean, again, it's beauty's in the eye of the beholder, right? And, I mean, we all love Richmond. We know what job he did on Bruce Smith. We know how he changed things for the Dolphins. But Tony Baselli, you know, had that, maybe that national allure. I don't know. You know, it's hard to say.
He was in Jacksonville. Like, why did he have national allure from Jacksonville when Richmond Webb was Dan Marino's left tackle? You want to talk about national allure. So that's another interesting thing. The funny thing is when Jason Cole was here, we got into a big debate with him on Baselli and Richmond Webb. But, you know, so that's another question I have for you. When you say beauty is in the eye of the beholder, I actually have great respect for the process. I learned a lot about it when JT went through it, and kind of fascinating to me. And the panel's incredible, and there's just a wealth of knowledge, and I think the depth of backgrounds there from you also. But there are some people that would say, well, should this group be the beholders? And so what do you think about when folks attack the process?
Well, a couple of things. I do want to point this out about Baselli. When I say Jacksonville, think of Jacksonville when they first started. Because in 1996, it's a team that made the AFC title game. They were in the playoffs basically every year that Tony Baselli played. And they were a primetime type of team at that time.
But so was Richmond Webb and Dan Marino and the Miami Dolphins.
Understood. And maybe just people just don't think that Richmond was a Pro Football Hall of Famer. I can't account for it. I mean, he makes a cut to like 125 names and then doesn't make it to the 25. So 49 voters.
How do you make it to the Pro Bowl all those years and get the All-Pro years and not be a Hall of Famer like he did? I mean, I think he stopped making a Pro Bowl like year 8 or so, right?
Well, and this is something that's interesting because, you know, sometimes it's one guy at a time. And let me be honest here. I'll give you the Cincinnati Bengals, right, with Willie Anderson. You know, Jeff Hobson, if you start trying to push too many people on your team for the Pro Football Hall of Fame, you're going to split votes and you're not going to be able to give maybe enough attention and love to somebody. So it's almost like one at a time. Zach Thomas goes in. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, we have a period with the Dolphins here, quite honestly, over the past 15 years or so, where we're not going to have a lot of Hall of Fame discussion about players who are on this team. Maybe then it's an ability to look at Richmond Webb, you know, to see that. Or even when it comes to a seniors candidate, why Richmond Webb should be under consideration for it. When you talk about attacking the process, Seth, I can understand, you know, when it comes to transparency, would you want to know how 49 voters voted? With that, I mean, I don't know if there's a perfect system to have it in. It's tough, you know. I mean, it makes the Hall look petty, I guess, when Terrell Owens doesn't get in on the first ballot. Considering all that he did, you can have people argue, look, statistically, this guy dominated the game. What else could you ask for? He took the Philadelphia Eagles to their only Super Bowl under Andy Reid. I can go off on T.O.'s accomplishments, but maybe not great with the media and maybe disruptive, to say the least, on some teams. And it was held against him.
I know that was one of the arguments against him.
Yeah, so tough. It's a tough debate.
I didn't know that was a criteria, though. Is that that's a criteria as well?
Well, making your teammates better is one, right?
Well, it's supposed to be. It's an interesting question because it's supposed to be what takes place between the lines. And, you know, like on a game day. And that's what you should be looking at. But I don't think you can ignore the way that a player may impact a team culture for the better or for worse. You know what I mean? I think that's an important thing that you have to consider.
Well, what about some of the guys that are in the Hall that had terrible teams their whole careers? I mean, what would they do to help their team?
Well, I mean, Cortez Kennedy would be one. Kennedy. He was the NFL Defensive Player of the Year on a 2-14 team, right?
Right.
So, I mean, there's that. And then you get into this argument, too, which is another rabbit hole to go down. But, you know, why players like L.C. Greenwood of the Steelers, or I mentioned Bob Kuchenberg. How about Jake Scott? I mean, how about players like this that were really difference makers, but then people say, oh, well, you're going to put everyone from that team in the Pro Football Hall of Fame? And so then you discriminate against a player who could have been a Pro Football Hall of Famer on a lesser team, but because so many of his teammates are in the Hall, now it works against him. So it's a tough goal.
But that sounds like the goalposts are getting moved around every time. That does sound a little bit to me like the goalposts are getting moved around.
And think about this too, guys. I mean, in baseball, you have this vote. If nobody gets in the Major League or the Baseball Hall of Fame, that's it. You know, you still have a celebration in Cooperstown, but that's it. Now at the Pro Football Hall of Fame, we have to have a minimum of four people into the Pro Football Hall of Fame each year. And, you know, because as you know, in Canton, this is their big event. This generates so much revenue for the city. Right. So you're going in there. So you've got to put people in the hall. And I think it was Deion Sanders earlier this year who you know, put some shade on the hall and said, well, what really constitutes a Hall of Famer nowadays? And that gets tough. I mean, Juice, it's like if you were to say Jerry Rice is the standard, he's a Hall of Famer. So who else belongs with Jerry Rice in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, right?
Yeah, there'd be
nobody,
15 guys.
Right? Nobody, yeah, right?
I mean, it's, you know, so it's an incredible honor, and I feel for the people that are up for it and don't get in and have to deal with so much of it. And it really affects not only them, but their friends, their family. They're pulling for him. And you've seen it 8-9 years of a guy having to sit there and deal with the disappointment of having his name brought up and then having that taken away from him. It's a tough situation. That's why I think that all I can do is the best job that I can, vote the way that I really feel like it is, do as much research as I can going in, and then we'll see if others feel the same way.
Do you carry the weight of that pressure ever? Do you feel, because I know you're a you know, I think when you get past the surface of the mullet and the goatee and all the things we talked about earlier, I think you are a guy who emotes and feels things. And so I wonder, like, we're talking about this and we're giving you a hard time a little bit about Richmond Webb, but do you feel some of that pressure when you go into that room, when you go into the room of the 15?
I have to be objective. You know, I do. And I have to listen.
Mean pressure like from one side or the other. Mm-hmm. I mean, just the idea that you're going to, some people's dreams are going to be pulled.
No, I don't feel that. But let me say this. I have not been a presenter yet. And that is where you feel the pressure. I mean, poor Armando, he's going nuts trying to get Zach Thomas in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And so he's trying every year. And you have to sort of keep the presentation fresh, you know. And, that's part of it as well. So I think that there's that. I think, too, when you have a player that's come up time and time again, how do you keep it fresh? You know, John Lynch, I think, was, what, a 9-time finalist? I mean, in the group of 15. After a while, how do you find new information to try to support your candidate to get them over the top? Sometimes you just know that it's time, right? Like, I really feel going into this year's Pro Football Hall of Fame class, we're probably going to have two first ballot inductees. In my opinion, handicapping it would be Joe Thomas and Darrell Rivas. And after that, I mean, Dwight Freeney and Robert Mathis are very worthy, but are they so good that they jump to Marcus Ware and Jared Allen in the pecking order? And I think that some of it, too, is pecking order. We all want instantaneous. We all want first ballot. Well, not everyone's a first ballot player, but you might belong to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. You may have to wait your turn, and that's sometimes what happens. Or you get a log jam at a position. Think about how many times we had Tim Brown, Andre Reed, Chris Carter, and all those votes nullifying, and then nobody could get through. And year after year, we're voting on these three and splitting our votes. Finally, one of them gets a consensus, and the other one goes in, and the other one goes in. So I think for those who have done this process a long time, you show a respect for the people who have been finalists for a number of years. And ultimately, as we like to say, we get them out of the room and we move them on, because otherwise, don't keep bringing them back in the room. If you're that committed to not voting for them for the Pro Football Hall of Fame, leave them off your vote from 25 to 15, and let's vote on somebody else.
That's a fair point. That's a fair point. Man, I appreciate that insight.
Stuff, hell yeah.
So I want to go, and we're a little out of order here, but I want to go back to those players that you covered during your tenure there with the Dolphins. And you talked about how Jimmy was willing to take gambles on, you know, sometimes a motley crew. His first overall draft pick that he ever had as a Miami Dolphin was Darryl Gardner. And you weren't here for Darryl coming into the league or coming into the Dolphins locker room, but you were a part of his departure. And, you know, you got to share that story. I don't think it's one that many folks know.
Well, I mean, basically, Darryl Gardner gets cut. He's got a back issue, okay? And if I'm remembering this correctly, his agent, Neil Schwartz, and I love me some Neil Schwartz, but he essentially wrote a manifesto about Darryl Gardner and the greatness of Darryl Gardner. And he brings us to Darryl Gardner's house to talk with Darryl. Tremendous, right? We got the lawn service guy who looks like he's scared for his life working for Darryl Gardner, okay? I'd be just absolutely horrified. I mean, just so we get there, we've got...
And it was a palatial estate. Like, it was... Huge. I remember that place.
Huge. So we go to the sauna, okay? And there are liquor bottles everywhere. I wish my bar was stocked as nicely as all those empty bottles were right there. Everywhere. And Daryl talked about himself, I believe, as a modern day gladiator and all of this stuff. It was completely gonzo, right? This would have been in today's world with the internet. I mean, this story would have just lived on and on and on and on. So that was Daryl. I mean, he had his issues, man. He really, really did. And, you know, look, talented enough player. I think that maybe just because he looked like, you know, such an incredible specimen that they overrated his ability a little bit. I think Tim Bowens was a better defensive tackle as a
1,000%.
But they were good. I mean, they were a really good combination, but Daryl and his life spiraled out of control. You know, things like this that had gone on that, you know, caused the Dolphins after signing him to an extension to release him. He went on to Washington, went on to Denver, and just really fizzled. And you know, it's always going to be one of those cases of what could have been for Daryl Gardner. Because I'm not saying he's a Pro Football Hall of Fame talent, but the guy could have played a long time in this league and ended up cutting it short. And that back issue didn't help either.
Oh, definitely did not help him whatsoever, man. But, you know, a lot of things didn't help him, bro. A lot of things did not help him out. You know what I mean? So it is what it is, man. You know, and I'm glad you mentioned Timbo, because we all probably agree about Timbo's contribution, how good he was, and how great he was for this team compared to what, you know, what Shorty was doing.
Well, it's funny because if you ask, you know, the outsider, who is the player you would least want to be in a dark alley against, right? Most, you know, the outsider would say, oh my God, Daryl Gardner, right? Yeah. Easily Timbo. Easily. Not even close. That was a dude. No. That was a scary dude. And I love Timbo.
But, you know, let's go back a little bit to the Hall of Fame talk because, you know, we've had Jeff Darlington here on the show a couple times. And in his most recent appearance, he painted you as legendary yourself. Legendary, he said. In fact, Jeff, I mean, one of the most respected, you know, we know Jeff is one of the most respected reporters in the business. But he struggled to find words to describe what life on the road was like with Marvez. Well, the hell is he possibly talking about, Marvez?
Every Batman needs a Robin, right? So I figure, you know.
That's the name of this episode. I'm telling you that right.
You know, so every Batman needs a Robin. And Marvez knows his way around on the road a little bit. Jeffy was a prodigy at the University of Florida. In fact, I read his story when he was working at the University of the Independent Florida Alligator on Channing Crowder catching wild hogs. I mean, Jeff was a prodigy. Yeah. And Jeff also liked to have a good time. He may have left that part out of it as well.
But no, he didn't.
This brought us together for many an exploit, such as Mattis Yahoo, going to see him back in Ohio, and maybe a 5 a.m. night, Fear and Loathing in Akron on Pro Football Hall of Fame weekend. Partying with the taxi driver. God bless, that was a mistake. But the point is that you know, somehow we survived all of this together. But yes, you know, it was fun though, but it was a different time. These things don't happen now, right? I mean, you hear legendary beat writer stories about guys out on the road because the day would end. The day would be over. It'd be like, okay, I filed my story. It's 9 o'clock at night. Only bad things can happen from here. Let's go, right? Like that was just how it was, but not anymore, you know, because you really have to be on call 24 hours a day. I just feel like there's a different type of individual maybe covering the beat than there was before. You know, degenerates like me weren't really, you know, that we were around then, not so much anymore.
I was going to say, I can guarantee you everybody's different than you, dude.
You know, well, I mean, you know, it's just that was a Hall of Fame type performance. You know what I mean?
That was
worthy of beat writer Pro Football Hall of Fame type stuff. Again, though, different time, man. I really don't think you could pull it off today.
I love it.
It's so good. So I was in preparing here a little bit of a crossroads because I know you covered this team right up and through the summer leading up to Cam Cameron, as you indicated. But I'm going to save us all from that memory. We've had enough of those stories. I'm going to shift gears completely. And one of the areas that you and I really connected on from day one, beyond our daily working relationship, was your affiliation with professional wrestling. That you wrote a national column for the sport. You were a wealth of information. You were, I wasn't saying encyclopedia, but half the listeners don't even know what those are anymore. But you were like Google for professional wrestling. And you would always come to me with these wild stories, behind the scenes stuff. And I grew up loving the WWF and all of those things. So talk about your history with the wrestling industry and how, you know, your expertise, your relationships and all of that positioned you for your current role with AEW Wrestling.
It's a wild situation. So I grew up a pro wrestling fan, right? I mean, my view of world politics is shaped by professional wrestling. For example, Ivan Koloff, terrible. Russia, bad. You know what I mean? Ivan Butsky, Polish, good. You know, and that was a big deal for six-year-old Alex.
Iron Sheik, Nikolai Volkov, no good.
Exactly. But later in life, Nikolai Volkov has changed, climate changed, and, you know, you had Mikhail Gorbachev, and Nikolai Volkov became a positive force when it came to Russia. Not that he was a real Russian, but nonetheless, you get my point. Neither was Ivan Koloff. But, you know, so I'm buying wrestling hook, line, and sinker. Growing up, I could not get enough professional wrestling. And the 80s come, and it's a boom, right? I get hold of a thing called the Wrestling Observer Newsletter. It's got all the inside information. My first issue, March 2nd, 1987. I'll never forget the day. Dave Meltzer writing it. He's a preeminent journalist in pro wrestling. We strike up a friendship. I've got all this information. I start going to local shows. I'm networking. I'm meeting people. The Miami Herald, where I'm stringing for at the time, I started there in high school. They know what a wrestling nut I am. And they say, hey, we ran a reader survey and they would like to see a pro wrestling column. Would you be willing to write one? I said, oh my God, yes. So I'm using stuff that had never been out there before. I'm using wrestlers' real names. I'm saying what's going to happen in the matches that have been taped 2 weeks from now. I mean, this stuff is avant-garde, right? So it's so popular, it comes to every week at the Miami Herald. I had a 976 number, or if you remember that, or 376, whatever it was, you know, you would call it.
Oh, I don't even know what that is.
Information, make a couple extra $100 a month, which is a big deal for my bar tab. So, you know, all that. So I leave, I carry it with me. I go to Dayton, Ohio. I've got, you know, the Dayton Daily News is covering it. Then I move to Denver. I'm insistent upon writing this wrestling column, and it works with Scripps Howard. Then I come to the Sun Sentinel. I'm still writing this wrestling column. I continue it all the way up through 2012. At that point, I'm done with wrestling. I'm not a WWE person. I'm not a Vince McMahon person. They were the only game in town, basically, and I was done. So I meet Tony Khan, though, at Jacksonville Jaguars training camp when I'm doing my SiriusXM job, and he introduces himself, and he says, yeah, I know we've got football in common, but I used to read you growing up, and I like the pro wrestling column. And Tony was on the AOL fan boards. I used to book his own wrestling promotion. I mean, he was diehard like me, but he's a little bit younger than me, but he was a huge wrestling fan. So as time went on, and Tony and I just struck up a friendship outside of football. I never used him as a source. I never tried to milk information from him. I just liked the guy. He was just a very nice guy. And we had wrestling. He got me back into watching wrestling. A couple of years ago, he says, hey, I'm going to be starting a wrestling company. You interested in doing it? Are you interested in being part of it? I'm like, yeah, I think I'll do that. So it led to me being able to work with All Elite Wrestling. And my role has changed through the years. I did some analysis work to start. I've done backstage interviews. I do a lot of the production work now. I prepare notes for the announcers. I work on the graphics that you see at the bottom of the screen. I keep records of all the wrestlers' wins and losses and double check all that. I mean, so it's a little bit of geek work, but every week I'm on the road back in high school. Still some of the old Marvez comes out from time to time, basically Tuesday and Wednesday night. And, you know, I just have a great time, and I'm very blessed at the opportunity that Tony has given me at AEW. I don't take it for granted. It's really been every week I'm back in high school. So I share a locker room with guys, you know, like Jake Roberts, like Arn Anderson, you know, Tully Blanchard for a while, Dustin Rhodes, you know, guys. That,
oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I mean, and these are my coworkers, you know, let alone the modern generation. And it also is nice to be around young people. Listen, I'm 51 now, man. I know that my time in a lot of ways has passed, but it does allow me to just sort of see how young people, you know, react to things, process information. I try to learn as much as I can about people, let alone pro wrestling. And that's really been a fun thing for me as well, doing these two full-time jobs that are driving me absolutely crazy sometimes. But it's a blessing. I mean, I get paid to talk about football on SiriusXM. I get paid to work in pro wrestling. If there's someone who has two better jobs, I'd like to meet him because I don't know if there is.
So, Marvez, you're telling me that Chief Wahoo McDaniel isn't really a chief?
Actually, Ed McDaniel, former Miami Dolphin, by the way, good tie in there. Once drank a quart of motor oil on a bet, which was a terrible idea on his part. Once ran a marathon, literal, like it wasn't an official marathon, but ran 26 miles on a bet. He also was arrested before a Dolphins game with Bob Ruggers, former Miami Dolphin, former pro wrestler, contemporary of Ric Flair. And when Ric Flair's plane went down in a plane wreck in the 70s, Bob Ruggers was part of it. And Bob, if I'm not mistaken, still might be working at a bar over on Sunset Boulevard that I did a big story on about 13 years ago for some day drinking.
This is how we got through practice, Juice, and training camp. Marvez would tell me these stories.
Wrestling stories. No, Wahoo McDaniel was amazing. He was great. And he also was big when I broke the story about Hulk Hogan and the steroid trial in the early 90s. You know, Wahoo had talked about wrestlers using steroids, which was a big revelation at the time, by the way. You know, anabolic steroids is back when people cared.
Well, you could tell most of those guys weren't on anything. They were just, their body types were just like, that's what it is, right?
And then it changed because the Road Warriors came along and they were so popular, everyone wanted a new Road Warriors, right? And WWF, right. It was just all these jumbo-sized guys. And unfortunately, you know, the combination of steroids with some other things led to a bunch of people passing. And it did. They did ultimately pass a wellness policy, but you just think about how many wrestlers might still be with us had there been some safeguards in place to so that they're not feeling. Listen, individual choice is individual choice, but I think so many folks felt pressure to look a certain way because it is a cosmetic industry. You know, you say what you will about whether it's sports entertainment or not, but you know, when you have everyone that's looking like Hawk or Animal, you feel like you have to look at like Hawk or Animal, and that can sometimes lead to shortcuts like that that maybe not so great, you know, when it comes to your long-term health. But that's part of wrestling. It's wrestling, by the way, the most fascinating thing I've ever done in my life.
But how about what I loved seeing? I went on and I was like, all right, let me go YouTube, Alex Marvez, AEW wrestling. And there you are, the Mean Gene Okerlund of AEW.
Gene.
And you're all suited up and you're asking the questions and it's the whole shtick and the guy's yelling at you, what kind of question is that, Marvez? And
yeah.
I mean, you had to be just eating that up.
I listen, it's an honor, right? And I try to treat wrestlers with respect, you know, and try to get their points across. That's why I try to blend in the background as much as possible. It's all about the wrestlers. I'm not selling a ticket unless my mom's going to go to a show. And I don't think even she would cross the street, to be honest. So I think that you're talking about, you know, you want to put the storyline across. You want to ask the question that elicits the best response from a pro wrestler. And my style is a little bit different. I go back to Gordon Soley in the old Championship Wrestling from Florida days, and he would call the matches very straight, very sports-like, you know, and that's what initially our company started as. We veered in a little bit of a direction now, maybe more toward the traditional pro wrestling. But to me, that's the era that I really enjoyed. And a lot of it is because, like anything, when you're a kid, you know, you'll always look back fondly, those halcyon days, if you will, right? And pro wrestling. But it's listen, again, I'm just to rub elbows with these folks, to call them my coworkers, you know, to be part of AEW, the most successful startup company in pro wrestling history. I'm so grateful to Tony Khan and his friendship and for bringing me on board. I'm grateful for what I do every week, going to a different city, you know, seeing the world and doing pro wrestling. I mean, and also on top of that, NFL radio. What else can I ask for?
Yeah, that's great.
Pretty
stuff.
Darn good.
All right, Marvez. All right. You know, we know you spent, you know, your career mostly writing on that 9 o'clock deadline before you, you know, you end out. But as a guy who's covered the NFL, you know, for nearly 30 years, you know, there's no deadline like the 2-minute drill. So we're going to put you through our version of the 2-minute drill, you know, before we let you get off of here. Is that cool?
All right. Let's try it.
All right. Bet. Big Seth.
All right. All right.
We're going to give him a timeout, Big Seth, or no?
If Marvez needs a timeout, and you know, this is it's 2-minute drill, but it's also a little bit like wrestling because we just play with space and time to make sure we get a good story out. So that's how we're going to do it. But we'll kick it off right now. Which NFL city is your favorite to visit and cover a single game in?
It would have to be New Orleans, you know, if I can make it to the game. But New Orleans, what an incredible city. Food, drinks, atmosphere. Plus, when you go to the game itself and they're cranking, let's get crunk. I mean, what's better than that? I mean, to me, that is just a very magical, dangerous, dangerous city.
Wow.
Like noon, like partying till noon Super Bowl week and blowing off the media availability. Like, danger. Yes.
All right, clock is running, Drew, because Marvez might go forever on this.
It's hard to recover from that. As you discussed earlier, you and Darlington share some great memories on the road. Who was your number one wingman, though, when you look at your NFL misadventures?
I'd have to say Todd Archer, because Todd was the yin to my yang. Todd made sure I got home safely, which was how we met in Baltimore on the road. He got me back from the horse you rode in on, the Edgar Allan Poe Bar in downtown Baltimore back in 1996, and struck up a friendship. And we're very opposite people, and I think that's what really helps a lot.
That makes sense, because I was surprised by the answer, but when you explain it makes perfect sense. All right, which Miami Dolphins player who you covered would have made the best professional wrestler, and which pro wrestler could have best helped the Miami Dolphins of your era?
Oh, I think that Darryl Gardner would have been an incredible pro wrestler just because of the look, the size. Now, I'm not sure if he would have really, and this is not a knock on intelligence, I just don't know if he would have grasped the concept of pro wrestling and not hurting people. You know what I mean? And trying to make it look good. But, you know, but he just had the physique, the look. I mean, he was absolutely horrifying. I mean, who'd want to face him in the ring? And what wrestler could have helped the Dolphins? Maybe MJF, our current AEW world champion, because it would have added some swagger at a time in the early 2000s that the Dolphins needed a little bit of swag.
Okay. Who gave a better silver screen performance? Dan Marino and Ace Ventura, Jimmy Johnson in The Waterboy, Ricky Williams in Struck on You, or Alex Marvez in Draft Day?
My scene got cut, so it definitely isn't me, but I did go to the premiere. They flew me out. They felt bad for me. So we go, and it's, you know, we're all Darlington, everybody. And two things happen. Number one, you know, get pretty hammered before the showing. And we, I've got a guy in front of me. I don't know, I have to do this red carpet. A little, you know, black dude with a neck roll. And I'm like, I wonder who this guy is. Oh, it's Mike Tyson, who I would later, later go on to interview in AEW. So it all comes full circle, right? So we had that.
Love it.
But, you know, so we had that one. But, you know, the cool part about that is Kevin Costner. And hey, Jeff and I hung out with Kevin until about 2 a.m. The night of the showing. And he was the most down-to-earth guy. I think he just enjoyed being around people. And we answered his sports questions, and he was really cool. And by the end of the night, Jeff and I basically like this to Costner. You'd be good now. You know what I mean?
That's
absolutely absurd. So we had that. But, you know, when you mentioned Dan Marino, anything that has to do with Ace Ventura, Ray Finkel, everybody, that's it. It's Danny. Although Kim Bokamper really was the correct answer to this question, imprinting the ring upon Jim Carrey's head. That would have been
it. Bo did a great job. Shirtless, no less. He did a great job. All right. There's a reason why you cover the NFL and you don't call the two-minute drill from the sidelines, but because we've totally just blown through the clock. But I'm going to get this last question in. Steel Cage Battle Royale featuring the writers from your time on the Miami Dolphins beat. It's Marvez, it's Salguero, it's Cole, Chris Perkins, Ethan Skolnick, Todd Archer, Barry Jackson, Joe Shad. Throw in Bullet Bob. Who is left standing at the end?
You know what? I got to give credit to Armando because I will say this, you know, longevity. I met Armando in high school. He was working at the Neighbors branch. For those who remember what Neighbors was a Miami Herald supplement that would come out on Sundays and Thursdays. And when the Miami News folded and Armando was covering the Miami Dolphins back then, he didn't have a job. So the Herald hired him, but they put him in this bureau in Hialeah. I was in high school. I'm looking to write as much as I can. I would write Armando's stories for him. Okay. So even as competitive as it got, I could never get mad at Armando because he helped me. You know, when I was a young guy, it was very gracious with it. He'd give me a few story ideas. And I don't even know if he knew what he was doing at the time. But I think that an honorable mention to Barry Jackson. Hi, because he has survived and he is the backbone of the Miami Herald. You could put him on anything. He is going to be relentless in what it is that he does. He's a perfectionist. I go back with him keeping stats for high school football games in 1987 at the Miami Herald. He was covering Miami Beach High School quite a bit because he is a high tide graduate. And he is a guy now that's like almost an institution in South Florida, you know, not only covering sports media, but every team. You can put him anywhere and you know you're not only going to get a great job, but probably break some news along the way. So I think those two are great. Listen, Jason Cole speaks for itself. Obviously, some great names there. And Bullet Bob Emanuel Jr., his poor father fell off that airplane wing. God bless. And Bullet Bob, which named after Bullet Bob Armstrong, by the way, former pro wrestler. So that's
so great.
Yes. So, I mean, but that is a great battle royale. I got to tell you, you know, if we can only settle our differences that way. And, you know,
It felt like it when I went down that spiral staircase.
Staircase. That thing was miserable. Oh, my God. And then you had the old Dolphins headquarters, how you learned how to sandbag. Like Barry Jackson would hang out in the lobby somehow. Somehow he had the weakest bladder in all of sports. It was remarkable because he had to keep walking back and forth to see who was around and who was coming in the front door.
Which is probably why he wouldn't win the Battle Royale. So Salguero gets it for longevity. That's the two-minute drill in about 6.5 minutes, but he did an outstanding job. The last thing I'll leave you with before we get you out of here is you talk about Barry Jackson, and it is crazy that some of these names are still on this beat. But I don't know how much you've watched any of Mike McDaniel's pressers. You know, he does his daily pressers. But Barry opens up every question, and Coach McDaniel has so much fun with him and the twofer question. And they actually have this really fun rapport that it is to watch those two guys go. So, Barry's still grinding, man.
He is. And that's what he is. He is a grinder. But he's such a wealth of knowledge. The South Florida sports scene would be so much worse off without Barry Jackson, honestly. And I have a world of respect for Barry. I mean, he is just – He's phenomenal at what he does. And, you know, again, he and Armando at the end, I'd like to see that if it was just settled between those two. Barry might find a way. You never know. You know,
I don't know. Somebody's going to have like a foreign object in their trunks and they're going to come out of the top on that. He is Alex Marvez. You can call him the dude. you are pretty damn good at what you do too, sir. So I greatly appreciate you spending some time with us, and you definitely, when you get into town, you better give us a call. I don't know when it'll be, but I know Juice and Preach will be ready for the ride. I'll probably be the guy that's tapping out.
I am down to ride.
Awesome. I absolutely love it. Thank you so much for having me in the fish tank. I do appreciate it. Hopefully I swam and didn't sink.
You damn right. Thanks for diving in, Marvez.
You're now diving into the fish tank.
Sitting down with Seth Living, Seth. OJ, Juice Man, ooh, and this is strictly for them true fans, Dolph fans, number one. Of course, y'all, this ain't no ordinary sports talk. Dive up in that fish tank. Go get your aqua orange. Yeah, it's time to dive up in that fish tank. It's only legendary talking when you dive up in that fish tank.